So many of you know I'm from West Virginia. I come from a family of storytellers. My mom could turn the most ordinary occurrence into a tale worth telling. She would assume the right posture and tone of voice for the person that she was representing. That's how I know family members who died before I was born, like her Uncle Pete or her cousin Alice. Uncle Pete was always kind of like this, you know, a little voice, but over her long life, I heard her tell some of these stories dozens of times, but each time I loved watching her tell them. Her trove of stories is one of the things I miss about her. But on this day when we honor mothers, many people are not blessed with the loving maternal relationship that I had, as Willow shared. Many of these relationships are complicated. So instead, I want to honor families more generally, as we've been talking about, both those we are born into and the families that we choose for ourselves. Family structures have always been fluid. That ideal of mom, dad, and two kids dates to 1950s sitcoms for the most part, not reality. Television quickly caught up, though. In the 1960s, we saw a blended family in the Brady Bunch. Later TV programs showed us extended families like the Tanners of Full House, the Barones of Everybody Loves Raymond. TV also depicts groups that function as families. Think about the six young adults in the TV show Friends and what they meant to each other. Anthropologists use the term fictive kinship to describe family-like ties outside of our relatives by blood or marriage. People who join close communities like military or religious orders use the language of sisterhood and brotherhood, things about the band of brothers in the military. Also fraternities, sororities, lodges, and other fraternal organizations use that language. For people who have no close families or whose families have failed them in some way, fictive kinship may replace real kinship. So today, in honor of my mother, the storyteller, I'm going to share some stories about different family structures. Some of these are real, some of them are from my own background, others are fictional, but they reflect the reality that many of us experience. Through these stories, we'll see how relationships with different people weave together the social fabric of our lives. The warp, I think they're usually vertical strands that on the loom or sideways, whatever, are the threads that we can't change. These are the family relationships that we are born into and the people we're stuck with for better or worse. But the weft are those that we weave over and under the warp. Each person a different thread. Some of them are short, some of them run throughout our whole lives, but all of them make us who we are. They create the fabric of our lives. My grandparents, Homer and Gertrude, met when Gertrude came to teach second grade at the school where Homer was the principal. Teaching did not pay enough to support a family, though, so as they welcomed four children, Homer went to work selling Delco light generators to farms and other rural homes in southern West Virginia. 13 years into their marriage, Homer suffered a stroke while building a set of steps onto the back of a house that they rented. He died a few months later at age 42, leaving Gertrude to rear four children in the Depression. She had not worked since getting married, and her teaching qualifications were no longer valid. I remember my aunt saying how she despaired that how could she go back to school and update her credentials when she had these four little children. But she rejected offers from relatives to raise my mother, who was three, and my aunt, who was five at the time. She kept her family together, and she went to work as a sales clerk at JCPenney. The oldest son, Davis, had a paper route, and the second oldest, Eber, watched his two little sisters. We have pictures of him with my mom on one side and Myra on the other. That's how they grew up, they said. Relatives on both sides of the family helped out. Gertrude's mother and brothers lived with them off and on and helped with the children. The children also spent summers on Homer's brother's farm. And at the end of the summer, their Uncle Kurt would bring them home with a car loaded down with produce to help them get through the winter. Homer's first cousin, Alice, who Gertrude had only met once before Homer died, became her best friend and helper. She would visit once or twice a month, and help with the children. They remember her giving them each a dime to go to the movies and always a penny for the tax to make sure they didn't have to pay anything extra. The children then grew up with a sense of gratitude for what they had and no sense of being deprived for what they lacked. When the thread of Homer's life was tragically cut short, the extended family stepped in, weaving in care and support. Gertrude stepped up and she raised four remarkable people. She was part of their lives until her death at age 92. Another story from West Virginia. At 8 a.m. on February 26, in 1972, a coal waste dam on the Middle Fork of Buffalo Creek collapsed following a heavy rainfall, releasing 132 million gallons of water, coal waste, and silt into the narrow mountain valley below. Over the next 3 hours, a torrent of black wastewater tore through 17 communities along Buffalo Creek, sweeping away homes, family members, even entire families. In the end, 125 people lost their lives, over 1,000 were injured, and hundreds of homes were damaged or destroyed, leaving between 4,000 and 5,000 people homeless. I remember hearing that as survivors gathered in makeshift shelters, fragments of families paired up to form new family units. An orphan boy was taken in by a family that had been left childless, an elderly woman by a family that could care for her. In what seemed like an instant, holes were ripped in these close communities, tearing apart neighborhoods and families, but they picked up other threads and wove new relationships together. Families were created out of shared trauma. People who had suffered unspeakable loss reached out to each other and found ways to weave their lives together. A story from the TV show Pose that came out a few years ago. A talented teenage dancer named Damon is disowned by his black family when they discover that he's gay, and he ends up homeless in New York City and is taken in by a trans woman named Blanca Rodriguez Evangelista. Damon becomes the first member of her House of Evangelista. Pose tells the stories of these family-like houses that were part of ball culture in New York City in the 1980s and 90s, where many LGBTQ+ persons of color who were rejected by their families found a home together. In ball culture, drag performers compete and are judged on elaborate costuming, hair, makeup, and stylized dance movements called voguing. Such houses are families in every sense of the word. They live together, headed by a mother or sometimes a father, who care for and mentor their adult children in every way that a parent would. After taking Damon off the streets and into her home, Blanca enables him to study dance, and he ends up working as a dancer and a dance teacher. His siblings in the House of Evangelista bear similar marks of rejection by mainstream culture, but they find a home as Blanca's children. We see these characters negotiate HIV/AIDS, drug culture, sex work, rejection by their families of birth and by their married lovers, many of whom are white, even by others in the queer community, where they still remain on the fringes. But they maintain a fierce loyalty to each other, and even to other houses who they compete against at the balls, but to whom they're bonded by their common experiences. These families allow them to be who they are. They are freed from the restrictions that their families and communities had placed on them. They weave wildly colorful and richly textured lives. They find a family, even as they remain on the fringes of mainstream society. Many families include members from the more than human world, most obviously our pets. We can tell a lot of stories there. But kinship can extend to all of life. I'm going to now read part of an essay by Enrique Salmon, an ethnobotanist whose roots go back to the Sierra Madres in Mexico. Salmon writes, The dark creases and lines on my grandma's face deepened as she smiled at my eagerness to learn about plant medicine. To my young mind, she seemed the perfect grandma. Her white hair contrasted with her brown skin. The brightness of the sun deepened the wrinkles and creases on her face. She cooked the best cactus fruit jam. She always had cookies around when I came to visit, and she seemed to know everything about the land. One day in our yard that was dotted with herbs and fruit trees, I watched her bend over to pick a sprig of bahuena, spearmint, and hold it out for me to smell. Her old faded cotton dress with the flower print outlined her frail 80-year-old frame. Her full set of teeth glistened as she smiled, watching me enjoy the scent. Then in a voice made scratchy from smoking, she explained, "That is what bahuena does to your stomach. It makes it smile." I cannot forget the many times when my grandma or mother rescued my upset stomach with some hot tea of bahuena spearmint. Always after just one cup, my insides would begin to smile again, ready for more food that I probably shouldn't eat. I understand now what my grandma and mother, as well as my grandfather and other family members, were teaching me. They introduced me not only to plant knowledge, but also to a frame through which I place myself into my environment and universe. I learned the names of plants, their uses, and their place in Rarámuri culture, philosophy, and cosmology. I understood them to be relatives and living beings with emotions and lives of their own. I learned that they are part of my life as well, and that I should always care for them. Salmon's family then extends to plant life. They recognize that plants and animals live interdependently, that we cannot live without each other. Together, Salmon writes, they form the breath of life, Iwigara. He concludes, plants are as important to the Rarámuri as are our non-plant relatives. There is little distinction between our world and that of non-humans. We all share the same breath. I am the mint tea, the bahuena, that Grandma used to offer to soothe my ailing. For indigenous people like his Rarámuri culture, all of life is a canvas, and every living thing is a strand within it. Witches and other pagans feel that same deep connection to the earth. Our choir is now going to sing us a final story. This is about a daughter who embraces her primal instincts and rejects the artificial constraints of modern society. Each of our lives is a thread, weaving under, over, around, and through the lives of others to create the fabric of community. Those who are blessed with close families are woven into an already strong fabric, while others have to strengthen their lives by seeking those close connections. People weave in and out of our lives at different times, helping us become our true selves. The Polish student who lives with your family for a year during high school. The friends you spend Thanksgiving with when none of you can go home. The people you watch movies with who are in another state. The church community where you find acceptance that you never experienced from your family of origin. The more threads that run through our lives, the stronger and more richly textured is our social fabric, as their stories become part of our story. I want to close with just the last part of a UU litany that was written by the worship group called Enfleshed. There is no me without you. We shape one another. The sacred that birthed us weaves our lives together so that we can only find ourselves through shared becoming. For my journey and all its winding ways, for yours, for all the saints who labored for what is, all the kins whose lives made ours possible, for all those yet to come, for whom living our truths today will mean breaking possibilities open for them tomorrow. We pause, we give thanks, we acknowledge this is loving and being loved. Blessed be.